I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about guns. Days after the 15th anniversary of the Columbine High School mass shooting, and just weeks after the Indiana General Assembly changed state law to allow guns on school property, the National Convention of the National Rifle Association is coming to Indianapolis. We will talk about the national debate about guns and the laws regarding them. My guests will be Dr. Steve Dunlop of Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence, and Carmel attorney and Second Amendment expert Guy Relford. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits at WFYI.org. Twitter is WFYI. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. In anticipation of the upcoming National Rifle Association convention here in Indianapolis, we're going to be talking about guns, gun violence, and gun rights here on No Limits today. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits at WFYI.org. Twitter is WFYI, and Facebook is No Limits WFYI. My guests are Dr. Steve Dunlop, who is with Hoosiers Against Gun Violence. Dr. Dunlop, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's good to have you here. And Carmel attorney, Second Amendment expert, and firearms instructor, Guy Relford. Guy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's also nice to be here.
Well, we're going to talk, and I should start with a disclosure. Those of you who have read my columns over the years know that I've taken a pretty strong stand against some of the NRA's policies. And I should say in this forum, my focus is going to be primarily on posing questions and making sure that both sides stake out their positions. I'm going to try to get this debate and conversation beyond the sound bites and bumper stickers and really talking points. I'm going to start first. Dr. Dunlop, you've got an event that's connected to the NRA's arrival on Thursday. Hoosiers Against,
right?
Hoosiers
correct.
Concerned About Gun Violence. Do could you talk a little bit about what that event and what you would like the NRA to do?
Well, we thought that since the NRA is coming to Indianapolis, and since Indianapolis has seen increasing gun violence in the last 3 years, from about 80 homicides to 111, firearm homicides, that is. We think that there's some things we'd like to see the NRA do, because we think the NRA, well, they certainly don't promote gun violence. They make it more difficult for the community to cope with it, because it's so easy for guns to flow into the community, since background checks are not enforced on 40% of gun sales, since we have only a misdemeanor for concealed carry in Indianapolis. Can I just?
Sure, certainly, certainly.
What you had for breakfast. So we'd like to see that. We'd like to see open records on gun permits, because we know from data elsewhere that people with gun permits do commit crimes, and we're concerned about who's getting them. And we also know, by the way, that in the city here, some of the people who are criminals get access to a gun by having somebody who has a permit ride in the car with them with the gun. Mm-hmm. So if they're then stopped and a gun is found, well, they can account for the gun because they've got somebody in the car who's got a permit, even though the other people in the car might have felony convictions. We also think, just again, to slow the flow of guns to the wrong people, handgun owners should report lost or stolen guns so that it's easier to keep track of what happened to a gun when it's found in the wrong hands. We also think, and this is Senator Breaux is going to speak, that she wanted to remove from the shoot first law, disallow that defense when the person who does the shooting is the one who instigates the action. So you can't just avoid a trial, which is what the shoot-first law of defense allows you to do if you acted in self-defense. You don't have to go to trial. If you go up to somebody on the street and you start an argument with them and they start pushing and you start pushing and then you pull your gun and shoot them, you can't avoid a trial over that issue because you're the one who instigated the event. And that, by the way, is true in a certain percentage of these events, which about 50%, not that many, but let's see.
And
so,
could you cite the source too?
This is from the Tampa Bay Tribune's analysis of whether who started the confrontation when the defense was used, and if the victim did 104 times, but the person doing the shooting did 48 times.
Okay. Guy Relford, I want to give you a chance to respond to some of these ideas. I probably should point out that you're not here as a spokesperson for the National Rifle Association. You're a member and you have an expertise in Second Amendment litigation. That's, in fact, your practice, but you're not representing the NRA. And for our audience, I should say that we made multiple attempts to try to get someone from the NRA on the program, and we're not able to do so.
No, you're exactly right. I am a lifetime NRA member, and I'm an NRA certified firearms instructor, but I'm certainly not a spokesperson for NRA or employed by NRA.
Well, and let's walk through this list of what are public policy proposals mm-hmm. that Hoosiers concerned about gun violence would like to see the NRA sign off on. Presumably, it means not just the NRA. They'd like to see state and federal government sign off on it as well. Are there things on there that you find, if not objectionable, problematic in terms of Second Amendment?
Well, I think how we heard some of these issues framed, as well as the use of repeatedly discredited statistics, I think kind of frames a lot of the discussion and is typical of what we hear. Things like 40% of firearm purchases are made without background checks. That's from a study of a couple of hundred firearm purchases from several years back. And in fact, more detailed studies have showed that there's nowhere near that percentage. Question then becomes, though, what about background checks? I mean, are background checks a good idea or a bad idea? I personally won't sell a firearm to an individual without going through a federal firearms licensee and making sure they fill out the form, the 4473, and having a background check. That's a matter of personal responsibility, and I think that's how most responsible gun owners trade guns or buy and sell guns. The question becomes, how do you have an enforceable background check system as has been proposed without really, I think, infringing on the rights of individuals? And specifically, the Department of Justice has even come out in a memorandum and stated specifically that a mandatory background check system is unenforceable without a universal registration scheme. And that simply makes sense because there's no way the government can enforce a background check system without knowing who has what now so that they can determine who got what from whom, just mm-hmm. exactly like federal firearms licensees are required to track their inventories. So the question then becomes, how do we feel about a national mandatory registration program? There are many of us who don't want the government to have that information, don't feel the government should have that information, and feel
why not, if I might?
Well, because who's going to register their guns and who won't, for instance? I mean, we know the criminals aren't, so only law-abiding citizens are, which then makes us that much more subject to arbitrary governmental action in the future in terms of what the government might want to do with those guns that we've come forward and registered when none of the bad guys are going to register their guns. And that really is the problem with most gun control proposals we see. Is I always ask the question, because I'm not anti-gun control, quote-unquote, if gun control is logically designed to keep guns out of the hands of people who should not have guns, then I don't oppose it. And again, this is just me personally. Who should not have guns? Well, the dangerously mentally ill, unsupervised children, and criminals. Okay. So if those populations of people should not have guns, and if some legislative proposal is designed and logically calculated to keep guns out of the hands of those people, then I'm not going to oppose it. Question becomes, though, is who does the burden of proposed legislation really fall on? And if it's simply the law-abiding citizen and not criminals, then that I will always oppose.
Well, and let me We're starting to get questions already, so I want to try to get to this. In terms of it seems to me that argument about how the law will fall disproportionately upon the law abiding mm-hmm. could be made in almost any other circumstance too. That, you know, speed limits put a disproportionate burden on the people who drive carefully, or any other number of rules. What is the problem? You know, especially since one of the arguments that advocates for firearms as personal safety devices, and they argue that often it doesn't need to be used for it to be effective, in part if it's shown and it serves as a deterrent. What is the problem then with people knowing where the guns are?
Well, again, knowing which guns are. I mean, we're not going to know where the criminals' guns are. We're never going to know that because they're criminals and they're not going to comply with any mandatory registration program. So now, like for instance, in terms of the demand that the information be released on who has a license to carry handgun in Indiana, which is what mm-hmm. we call it. Okay, so we're talking about targeting a group of individuals who have passed a background check. They've gone through the governmental system. They've passed a background check. And so what do we know about them? We know they're not felons. We know they're not domestic batterers. We know they're not drug abusers. They're not alcohol abusers. We know they've not been convicted in the last 5 years of resisting law enforcement. We know they're not mentally ill. So we know all these positive things about these people, but for some reason we want to target them in terms of identifying where the guns are. Why not look at what laws we have on the books to take guns out of the hands of criminals and not focus on the law-abiding citizen?
Dr. Dunlap.
I don't want to change. Really, what we're asking for is open record on gun permits for those convicted of a violent crime. So we're interested in whether or not we are giving gun permits to the right people. This was studied in Indiana a few years ago by the Star, and it turned out there were lots of mistakes being made. And subsequently to that, the legislature passed a law saying, well, the press doesn't have any access to who has concealed carries. And one of the arguments used by the NRA at times is that people with concealed carry permits don't commit crimes, when we know that at least 600 deaths since about 2007 have been committed by concealed carry permit holders and a number of multiple murders. So we know that it's not a perfect system with the concealed carry, but we can't – at this point, it's hard to correct any difficulties because even if someone commits a crime, it's impossible to find out if they had a concealed carry permit or not.
We've gotten a question from a listener named David via Facebook. And if you'd like to send a question via Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. His question is, can a gun be violent by itself? Dr. Dunlap, I'll let you
start. Guns are inanimate objects. And to say that there's a problem with gun violence means proving that the presence of a gun increases the level of violence. Now, this is best known for suicides, for instance. Guns are a very important risk factor for suicides, and seen that guns with homes have a lot more suicides than guns without. It's done by young men. They're less likely to be mentally ill. They're often acting impulsively. They've often been drinking. So the gun isn't violent, but the gun in the situation creates violence. Or the police officer recently shot his wife over in a domestic dispute. The gun didn't do that, but the gun being there made what might have been a fisticuffs or some other much milder argument into a homicide.
Well, and the argument you hear, though, Dr. Dunlap, on the other side, is there are many other tools in daily life that can be used for violent or deadly purposes. You know, knives, automobiles, any number of things.
And to that point, Japan has a suicide rate 3 times what we have in the U.S., and guns are simply not owned by the public in Japan. How then could they possibly have that suicide rate if the public simply doesn't own firearms? It means they find other ways. Otherwise, we'd be banning prescription drugs in tall buildings.
It's true that suicide is more complicated than just guns. And in Japan, it is considered a socially appropriate way out of certain situations. But in the United States, if you look at the household number of guns in a state and you look at the number of suicides, you find out that there is a close relationship. That, for instance, a study was done from 2000 to 2002, and it looked at the states with high gun ownership and states with low gun ownership. And it looked at suicides by firearm and not. Firearm suicides were 9,749 for a similar population in the high gun, and 2,609 in the low gun owning. Non-firearm suicides were about the same, 5,000 in both groups. So that left a total of about 6,000 suicides that could be accounted for by the presence of guns. Now, other studies, since I'm a psychiatrist, I do know a little about this. Mm-hmm. Studies have been done after suicides about the degree, the nature of the person who committed the suicide. And with firearms, it is typically someone who has less likely has a history of mental illness, more likely to be married, more likely to be connected with a job, and more likely to be intoxicated, so that it seems that it's and often it's an impulsive event in relationship to something bad that happened that leads to a death. For instance, again, with the police officer and his wife.
We will pick that up on the other side. We are talking about guns, gun violence, and gun rights here on No Limits. My guests are Dr. Steve Dunlop of Hoosiers Against Gun Violence, Carmel attorney, and Second Amendment expert Guy Relford. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about guns, gun rights, and gun violence in anticipation of the upcoming NRA convention. My guests are Dr. Steve Dunlop of Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence and Carmel attorney Guy Relford, who is a gun rights expert and Second Amendment, really, expert. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
So I know you guys are more focused right now on local concerns, but I wanted to address, what we've seen as far as the national news and these mass shootings at the theaters and Fort Hood and all these kinds of things, that time and time again, these people are on psychotropic drugs or on these mind-altering drugs. So I'm wondering, what kind of effect, this could have on these kinds of extreme events. We're talking about, I heard you guys talking about the police officer and, he might have been drunk and shot his wife and because she was cheating on him or something, whatever. But when we're talking about big events that are affecting national law, and are trying to affect bigger issues, where do these kind of drugging of our society, where do you think that factors in? Because we've all heard those commercials where it says might cause suicidal thoughts, might cause this or that problem if you take these drugs. So how responsible are the pharmaceutical companies, and how might that play into this?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Mark. Dr. Dunlop, since you're the psychiatrist
yes,
in the room, we'll let you
that
take that one
me.
First.
Well, first of all, mass shootings are very, very rare events. They are occurring more frequently than they did 20, 30 years ago, but only about 34 times a year is defined by the FBI with four or more victims. So that's 30 times out of 300 million people. And out of that 300 million people, let's say 10% have significant mental illness. So that's 30 million people. So 34 out of 30 million people commit these events. It's sort of unlikely, but most of them might be on powerful, drugs. I don't know. Unfortunately, they're sometimes not powerful enough. But it doesn't drive very many people to do this kind of thing. It requires a very peculiar set of circumstances for it to happen. And most of the time, the precipitating event doesn't have much to do with mental illness. It's a frustration or anger on the part of the person involved. For instance, in the Virginia Tech shootings, I think there were things going on at the school before, and with the Aurora shooter, he had lost his position as a graduate student. Now, he did have mental illness, but I don't think the drugs played any role in it. I think probably if he'd been adequately medicated, he might not have done it. So basically, there isn't any relationship that anybody's been able to show between pharmacotherapy and violent behavior. Now, whether pharmacotherapy might induce towards others, at least, whether it induces suicidal thinking, it may in certain circumstances. People are warned about that. But in general, if you take a large population of depressed people and you give them antidepressants, half antidepressants and half you don't, suicide will be higher in the group that's not treated.
Guy. Just looking at the mass shootings that we've seen, certainly in the last few years, just me as an individual observing those, there seems to be a couple of very common factors. One is a history of mental illness, and the other is they tend to occur in so-called gun-free zones where it's illegal for someone to be able to defend themselves. That's certainly true of a elementary school. It's certainly true in Aurora, Colorado, anyway, of a movie theater. So those tend to be the common dynamics to me.
But to be fair, we've also seen them at military installations, too, where there are a lot of weapons around.
Actually, no. And that's a major problem because since the Clinton administration, soldiers on Army bases are not allowed to carry loaded weapons. So they are absolutely gun-free zones, and soldiers who go there to commit those shootings know that.
Dr. Dunlap.
Well, I think, first of all, I'm not sure the Aurora Theater was a gun-free zone, or at least I don't know how that was enforced.
Yeah, it was. It was a local ordinance that said you cannot have a gun in a movie theater.
Did they check people coming in? Did anybody have any idea?
Well, what we know is the shooter knew it was a gun-free zone, and that was exactly
it was
my point.
Theater. I think the issue is that people who commit these shootings go to places where there's large numbers of people, and they're very hard to identify ahead of time. There has been one instance, for instance, in the shooting of Gabby Gifford in Arizona, where a gun owner did run up onto the scene. Now, he ran up onto the scene after the shooter had been disabled by civilians who were there, and he, for a moment, thought about shooting one of the people who had tackled the shooter because that person had the gun in his hand. And then, fortunately, he didn't do that. So Arizona is a situation. We very rarely have found a situation. These events happen so quickly that somebody with a gun has been able to intervene and stop them. And also, I'm not sure every gun owner faced with a young man wearing armor and firing a semi-automatic rifle is going to stand up in a theater and fire a Glock at him and draw his attention, even if he had one. So I think the answer is what other countries have done to avoid these problems, and Australia is perhaps the best example, is they simply got rid of the kinds of weapons that entice people to do this, which is weapons that are capable of rapid fire and semi-automatic weapons. And they haven't had one since.
Well, let me reframe this a little bit because I think one of the things that drives people a little bit crazy about this discussion is that it seems like the arguments are coming from two different planes of reality, that there is no place where, you know, we can agree and try to build some accord. Some of the numbers, for example, I mean, the numbers would suggest that the United States does have a much larger problem with gun violence than most of the other developed countries in the world. I mean, the numbers I've seen from the United Nations and elsewhere suggest that it's 20 times the average of the other developed nations in the world. Is there nothing that can be done about that, Guy?
Well, again, I think we need to look at what the facts are and make sure that we're being very factual. There was a study done actually by Harvard University that looked at the extent of gun control in countries around the world and compared the extent of gun control with their murder rates. And in fact, there was no reduction in the countries with the strictest gun control. A country like Russia, for instance, where civilian gun ownership is basically outlawed, has a dramatically higher murder rate than the United States. So I think the reason we are like two ships in the night a lot of times, passing each other on this issue, is we come from a fundamental difference of opinion on the issue of whether criminals will follow the law. If all we're going to do is go pass more laws that criminals are going to ignore, and through that simply burden the rights, the material constitutional rights, of law-abiding gun owners, then that's why we're always going to have a disconnect, because of that fundamental disagreement as to what the effect of laws are on a population of people who don't follow the law. That's what makes them criminals.
Let me comment.
I'll give you last word, and then I want to get to callers.
Okay. Well, I think Russia's a poor example because I'm not sure they enforce any laws in Russia very successfully. And we'll talk more about that after the break.
No, I want to get to callers, so I'll give you a chance to respond. Yeah. Yes, no, go ahead.
Go ahead and respond.
Please.
I'm sorry.
Yes, please.
Yeah, if you look, for instance, north to Canada, a study was done in Canada where they asked people, have you been a victim of a crime? Mm-hmm. Have you been a victim of a crime in your home? Have you been a victim of a violent crime? And they got very similar answers for Canada and the United States. 33% said they've been victims of crime in Canada, 32% here, violent crime, 5% in both. percent of individuals victimized in the survey was 21%, and by violent crime, 2% in Canada, 3% in the United States. But when you look at homicides, the United States is far in advance. In the United States, we have 4.8 per 100,000. In Canada that year, they had 1.62. In Canada, firearm homicides were 0.5 per 100,000. In the United States, they're 3.26 per 100,000. So, and there's also data that in states, if you look at the number of households with a gun in states, mm-hmm. there's a direct relationship with the number of homicides and the number of households with guns, because it's not only criminals who kill other people. Lots of killings involve...
Well, they become criminals when they do kill other people.
You know, I know, yeah, but I mean, there are people... A lot of crimes, a lot of killings are not committed by career criminals. They're committed by family members, and people shoot up their... You know, someone gets fired from a job, he goes up and shoots his employer, that sort of thing.
I think a question we have to ask is, are we really talking... We start talking about comparing countries. Mm-hmm. Are we talking about a gun issue, or are we talking about cultural issues? Look at countries like Australia and Canada. How many people below the poverty line do they have? What percentage of their population are incarcerated? What percent of their population have single mothers? What percent of the population have been incarcerated in the past? I mean, there are a number of issues that we have in the United States, unfortunately, that lead directly to an increase in crime rate, which frankly is one of the reasons that many people that I train, and one of the reasons that I train personally, and the reason I'm a gun owner, is I want to have the ability to defend myself from the criminal element that unquestionably exists out there. So to say that we have a criminal element in the United States, in my view, not because of guns, but because of cultural issues that we have specifically in this country, is that an argument an argument for or against gun ownership? And a lot of what I think we ought to be focused on when we talk about any number of these issues, whether they be statistics or studies or cultural issues, is what are we going to do about it? What's the answer? I mean, because we can cite statistics all day long, we say, all right, let's say that's a problem, whatever problem we're talking about. What's the solution? And is that simply stripping the rights of law-abiding citizens? My answer to that is no.
Are there any places, though? I mean, at some level, I mean, you know, if you're talking about 20 times the average of the other developed nations in the world, that we have, you know, gun-related deaths in this country per 100,000 of our population, do guns have any role in that? I mean, is there any place where we can sensibly regulate gun ownership and gun use that would reduce that number? I think we all could agree that that's reducing the number of gun-related deaths is a place we all ought to be able to agree.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Again, the question becomes, what's the solution, and where does the burden of that proposed solution lie? And if it's only on law-abiding citizens, then I suggest it's not a good solution.
We are talking about guns, gun rights, and gun violence here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Mark, welcome to the program.
Yes, earlier I heard the host make a comment about the difference when we were discussing registering guns with individuals who exceed the speed limit when they're driving their vehicle. And I would like to point out that the difference in people having driver's licenses that still break the law for the speed limits and such is that there is the Second Amendment. There is no amendment to our Constitution that guarantees an individual a right to a driver's license. We hear people all the time make the case that driving is a privilege, not a right. Well, owning a firearm and self-protection is a right that is guaranteed by the Second Amendment. And so I'd also like to make one quick point about the Second Amendment, that if a constitutional amendment or anything is adopted, it's usually minimized to a few words or a sentence or a paragraph. But beyond that sentence or paragraph is months and hours of debate and discussion. And when it is adopted, a lot of those discussions and time are not included in the actual amendment. But if you look at the Second Amendment and the discussion of our founding fathers, the right to bear arms was not just a military right or a hunting right. It was actually a right to for self-protection and self-preservation. And that's all I'd like to say.
Thanks very much for the call. Dr. Dunlop, I'm going to throw that to you because that does the...
Well, what does the Second Amendment mean? As with the rest of the Constitution, the Second Amendment means what the Supreme Court at the time says that it means. And this has shifted dramatically in the United States. As I understand, in the 30s, one of the courts said that it doesn't carry an individual right. It's a right to have a militia. As far as the history of the Second Amendment, it's very confusing and complicated. One of the arguments for the Second Amendment at the time it was put forth was for the southern states to keep militias because they were slave-owning states. And they were worried about slave revolts, so they wanted to be sure that they would be able to raise a militia and hold that down. So I would say the Second Amendment says what it says and means what the court says it means, and that can change with time. And the court, of course, in 1776 didn't have to deal with the kinds of concerns we have to deal with now from gun owners. You didn't have gun owners who could go in and shoot up an elementary school because there weren't those kind of guns.
Well, I guess that though we need to acknowledge, though, the Second Amendment does exist, and we've gotten another email question asking you to respond to, you know, the phrase shall not be infringed. Also ought to point out that in addition to the Second Amendment nationally, there's language in the Indiana Constitution that doesn't have any of the terms that people argue about it with the Second. It doesn't say militia. It doesn't say anything like that. It pretty much just says you have a right. If you're a Hoosier, you've got a right to own a weapon.
Yeah, Article 1, Section 32 of the Indiana Constitution says that people have the right to bear arms for the defense of themselves in the state of Indiana. That's all it says, and that's all it needs to say. And we really don't need to debate what the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution means because we have in 2008, the Heller versus D.C. decision, followed by the 2010 decision of McDonald versus Chicago. So the court has told us what the meaning of the term militia means and what the context was in 1789 when the amendment was ratified. And specifically, in 1789, who was the militia? It was everybody. It was us. Mm-hmm. Then it would have been all able-bodied adults, or excuse me, men. Today it would be all able-bodied adults. So that it's us. And when we talk about necessary for the security of a free state, we're talking about two things. We're talking about repelling a foreign invasion, and we're also talking about maintaining a protection against tyranny. Those things apply today as they applied in 1789. To say that we didn't anticipate modern weaponry in the Second Amendment in the drafting or formulation of it is exactly like saying we didn't anticipate the internet or television or radio when they drafted the First Amendment. It still applies perfectly and beautifully, and the Supreme Court has very recently confirmed that.
But to some degree, we can regulate the First Amendment.
Sure.
In interests of public safety. For example, we tell people now they can't text while they're driving. That, you know, in some ways is a curtailment of First Amendment rights, but we say when you're doing this in the public sphere, the public has a right to regulate your behavior. Is there any application to the Second Amendment, that argument that when you're in the public sphere, the public has the right to impose some control or condition upon how you use weapons?
No, I think you phrased that question perfectly. And the Supreme Court has said, and
Justice Scalia did too, even after the Heller decision, that there is room for regulation.
There is room for regulation. But the real debate and what was resolved through those decisions is, does the Second Amendment confer an individual right to bear arms? And the answer to that is yes. Can you regulate that to some degree, just like we do in Indiana? We don't have an unfettered ability to carry firearms on our persons. No, we have to have a license to carry a handgun. Serious violent felons in Indiana cannot even possess a firearm of any kind, and no one's contesting that. So there certainly can be reasonable regulation, but here's the legal test. Does it place a material burden on the core value of the constitutional right? And the core value of the constitutional right under the Second Amendment or Article 1, Section 32 of the Indiana Constitution is the right to possess a firearm for self-defense. So if it doesn't place a material burden on that, can there be some regulation? Yes. The question becomes, when does that material burden arise?
We are talking about guns, gun violence, and gun rights here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Again, we're talking about guns here on No Limits in anticipation of the upcoming NRA convention. My guests are Dr. Steve Dunlop of Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence and Carmel attorney, Second Amendment expert Guy Relford. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about guns, gun violence, and gun rights in anticipation of the upcoming National Rifle Association convention here in Indianapolis. My guests are Dr. Steve Dunlop of Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Concerned with Gun Violence and Carmel attorney, Second Amendment expert Guy Relford. Just before the break, we were talking about if there are ways to bring down gun violence, the levels of it. Dr. Dunlop, and because of the way the clock ran, we didn't give you a chance to respond.
What I wanted to talk about is that actually in a number of cities have seen decreases in gun violence. In fact, the city that's probably had the most dramatic success is New York. And in New York right now, it's down to 4 per 100,000, where in Indianapolis we're around 15 per 100,000. We just creeped ahead of Chicago. Another city is doing pretty well is Los Angeles, and it's in California, which has the strongest gun regulations in the country, and their death rate is around 6 per 100,000. And now these states are being tested by by legal challenge to what they've done, multiple challenges. So far as I know, they've survived them all, so that what they're doing has not been decided to put an undue burden on gun owners. Now, I'm not an expert in all of the things that they've done, and some of it has to do with policing as well as it has to do with control over gun ownership, but people have had success, and Indianapolis does not have to have this level of homicide. Now, the NRA is going to bring Bobby Jindal onto their stage, and his state has New Orleans, which has the highest homicide rate in the United States, about 40 per 100,000, so I don't think he's somebody we could ask, but there are examples of places that have done this, and they're being tested in the courts by people like Mr. Relford, but I guess they're in those cities. And so far, it's holding up.
We are talking about guns, gun rights, and gun violence here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I was calling to just mention that the kid a couple weeks ago who, you know, sort of went berserk in the school had the knives. And, you know, I think if you can, you know, you've often heard gun advocates or gun rights advocates say that, you know, well, you know, it's not just guns that can, you know, kill people. It's knives, baseball bats, so on and so forth. They have all these, cite all these things. But I think, I don't know if anyone died in that incident. This kid went nuts, and I think he might have hurt some people, but I don't think anyone died. And certainly if he'd have had a gun, I think there would have been a different result. Also, I just wanted to mention, I talked to a lot of my friends who are, you know, gun advocates, and they talk about self-protection. And if you have a child in the house, I have no idea how you could, with a clear conscience, keep a loaded gun somewhere to protect yourself. And I'd like to hear the gun advocate there maybe answer that question, how you could keep a loaded gun accessible enough that you would be able to protect yourself if someone broke into your house at night. And protect it from children getting a hold of it or their friends. And then finally, just one incident that happened out in Hollywood, or actually in Malibu Beach, a movie star had one of his neighbors who happened to be drunk accidentally got into his house and was stumbling through his house, and the guy came in, didn't recognize him, just saw a dark figure in his house. And if he would have had a gun, I would suspect that guy, that neighbor, who just happened to be intoxicated and got in the wrong house, I imagine that guy would have been shot. So, for every case that they think that they're protecting themselves, there's probably many, many cases of accidental deaths, children's getting hold of guns, and I've never heard them really speak to that, especially the self-protection folks.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. I'm going to give Guy a chance to respond here.
Sure. I mean, with respect to guns in schools, it's already illegal to have a gun in a school. So if we're trying to keep guns out of schools, that's already illegal. It's already illegal to murder students. So passing another law is silly when it comes to someone who's intent on murdering people in a school, because there are already plenty of laws that you have to violate before you can go murder people in schools with a gun or otherwise. With respect to locking up a gun in your home, I'm really glad we got a question on this, because to me it's one of the most important things we can really talk about in terms of gun ownership. I teach a class for a company I own called Tactical Firearms Training. We do classes every weekend out at Eagle Creek Pistol Range, and one of the things that we always talk about is how you cannot be a responsible gun owner unless your guns are locked up. What does locked up mean? We saw recently a company like Gander Mountains giving out free trigger locks. Well, putting a trigger lock on a gun doesn't mean that entire gun is locked up. It needs to be in a safe. It needs to be locked away. The good news is, for those of us who want to be able to protect ourselves in our homes, is we do have quick access gun safes. I have one mounted to the side of my bed frame. It's a steel safe. I'm the only one who has the combination. Somebody breaks into my home, they cannot get into that safe without a lot of time and a blowtorch. At the same time, it's a quick access safe, and I can open that safe in about a second, so that I'm the only one who has access to that gun. And that's what we say. You have to, as a responsible gun owner, it's mandatory. You have to make sure that unauthorized or untrained people cannot gain access to your guns. That's something that we absolutely prioritize and emphasize in our training.
What about the first part of Larry's question, though, that the gun provides an escalating factor, that the carnage would have been far worse in the Pennsylvania situation if that person had been using a firearm rather than a knife?
Fair question. And if they'd gone in there with a firearm and a lot of ammunition, could the carnage have been worse? Yes. Question comes back to what I asked earlier. What are we going to do about that? Are we going to outlaw guns? Are we going to take guns away from everyone? Are we going to eradicate the Second Amendment? I mean, we can quote statistics, or we can ask those rhetorical questions, which are good questions, but the question still comes down to, what are you going to do about it? What's the proposed solution?
Let me comment on a couple of things. Yes, of course, there's more carnage if there's a gun. Incidentally, at the time of the Newtown shootings, there was in China, someone attacked a school with a machete and wounded 24 children, but they all survived. Well, what are we doing about it? Well, in a sense, since we've decided that under the Second Amendment, not only can you have a gun, but apparently you can have a semi-automatic rifle and a 50-gun shot clip to it, and you can gain public places. So what we're doing is we're just hardening all of these places, making it harder and harder for people to get into them with guns. That's the only solution we have. Now, the question for that is, there the burden shifts from gun owners to all the rest of us. You know, the state of Indiana was going to put $20 million into putting police officers in schools. That $20 million is going to come from all the taxpayers, not just the gun owners. So there is a problem of burden for the rest of society. Gun violence costs the United States, according to different estimates, somewhere between $30 and $100 billion a year. And there about could be as much as $100 or a couple hundred dollars per gun. And we're all paying for it. So I think that to find solutions to these things, if they're not going to be changes in the mixture of guns that we're going to allow people to have, then it has to be that we're going to harden the places that people go. And we've had some success in doing it.
We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Eric. It says, it certainly seems as if these organizations that focus on gun violence and gun safety are less concerned with promoting and teaching the safe and lawful use of firearms than they are concerned with limiting or eliminating the Second Amendment right of Americans to keep and bear arms. The largest and by far most effective gun safety program in America is run by the NRA, Eddie the Eagle. So why don't these groups focus on developing additional gun safety classes for schools? Dr. Dunlop.
Well, first of all, the NRA has a lot more money than we do, so we'll let them do it. Also, we think that the problem is that this isn't getting through terribly well to everybody. We were talking about guns in homes, and somebody did, a study of what happens when there's shootings in a home. And they studied Memphis, Seattle, and Galveston, and they found 626 shootings to look at that occurred in or around a residence. 54 were unintentional shootings, so these were guns that weren't being stored right or handled properly. 118 were attempted or completed suicides. 438 were assaults or homicides. And 13 were legally justified shootings. Now, a lot of the assaults or homicides were not done with a gun in the home, but the point is that what Mr. Relford says is correct, that if you have a gun in the home, it should be kept locked up. Now, our feeling is that if there are children in the home, that should be not just encouraged, but required.
Mr. Relford.
Yeah, I think the question from the caller or Facebook poster is a great one. I think it's important to note here, the largest organization of instructors that teach firearm safety in the country is NRA. Mm-hmm. Now, I am an NRA certified instructor. That's where I got my training to go out and teach gun safety. I make an okay living as an attorney. I don't have to be out at the pistol range every weekend. Why am I out at the pistol range every single weekend? Because I'm teaching gun safety, because I'm passionate about that, and I'm doing that as an NRA instructor. So, you know, I think it's important to note NRA exists on a lot of different levels and for a lot of different purposes. And again, I'm not an employee or a spokesman, but they train more people in the safe and responsible use and ownership of firearms than anyone else in the country, probably the world, if I had to guess, and I think they ought to be acknowledged for that.
We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Linda who says, what about the influence of the NRA on legislation? Huge lobbying influence and money. Is that a distorting – does that create a distorting effect on this debate? I'm going to give each of you a chance. I'll start with you, Guy.
Well, I think the strength of the NRA comes from the fact that it has 5 million members. It is truly a grassroots organization. We just saw Michael Bloomberg come out and say, well, I'm going to spend $50 million and I'm going to outmuscle the NRA. Where he's completely misguided is that the strength of the NRA doesn't come exclusively from the money it spends. It comes from the fact that there are 5 million like-minded people who also are members of political PACs, who vote, who are vocal in local politics. So we've got 5 million people who have joined this organization because they value their Second Amendment rights. So does the NRA have an influence on the legislative process? Of course it does. But its real influence, which is exponential from the money it spends directly, are the fact that there are 5 million members who care enough to have joined the NRA and who vote.
Well, Dr. Dunlop, where does the money come from, though?
Most of it comes from the gun industry. For the gun packs. So there's a vast amount of money that comes to the NRA from the gun industry. It comes from the members as well, but most of it comes from the gun industry. And one can say there's a whole, you know, the NRA is interested in trying to make people safe and train them in guns, but it's also survives by the sale of guns. And you can find in some of their publications statements relating that with the opening up of the First Amendment, the shoot first kind of laws, that stimulated a lot of people to go out and buy handguns. The problem the gun industry has is that there's not much market left for hunting. And so they wanted to open up a self-defense market. Now, the fact that if you buy a gun, the chances of somebody in your home dying of a homicide doubles, and the chances of somebody in your home committing a suicide goes up by a factor of 3, despite all this training, is not terribly strongly emphasized in that regard. So that's the problem for people who buy into some of the things that the NRA is arguing for them, that they need to defend themselves. Actually, also like Mr. Relford and I, our chances of being killed by somebody in a homicide are about 1/7 or so the chances that we're going to commit suicide with a firearm. So, and this is in Indiana, by the way. This is data from Indiana mortality statistics. That for white males over about the age of 40 or so, for white males over about the age of 40, the homicide rate exceeds the suicide rate by firearm exceeds the homicide rate by firearm by a factor of 7. So if you go out and it's also known if you go out and buy a gun, it makes it higher. So those are issues, those are public health issues of increased risk associated with gun ownership, and they haven't changed with all the training that's going on.
I'm going to give you the last word on this, and then I want to move to another question.
I actually want to address something that's been brought up a couple of times, and I hadn't addressed it yet, and that is the so-called shoot-first law. That really is a dramatic mischaracterization of what the so-called stand-your-ground laws actually say. We have in Indiana a self-defense statute, and what it says is if and only if you reasonably believe that deadly force is necessary to prevent serious bodily injury or death of yourself or a third person, or to prevent the commission of a forcible felony. Only if those things do you then have no duty to retreat and can respond with deadly force. So shoot first is a silly characterization of those laws. Only if you believe reasonably, not just believe, but reasonably believe that you're about to be the victim of a violent crime can you then defend yourself? To call it shoot first is to ignore the fact that you are not the one who provoked the confrontation. And in fact, the legislation proposed here recently that would eliminate the ability to use self-defense if you provoke the unlawful action is already in the statute. It says specifically if you're the initial aggressor or if you've provoked the unlawful action that you cannot use any force in self-defense, much less deadly force. So we're well covered on that, and I want to make sure that people understand what the law really is in Indiana, not as it's being mischaracterized.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Tim who says, John, I'd just like to point out that there is a difference between laws that actually violate Second Amendment rights and laws that raise the fear of that possibility in the future. A law that requires a national registry is not the same as a law that infringes on gun ownership. Fair point, Guy?
Yeah, I think that is a fair point. And I think that those of us who don't like the idea of a national gun registry to some degree could be accused of having our paranoid conspiratorial hats on in terms of what could happen in the future, because that is the concern. And it's frankly a concern that I do have and that I believe is a legitimate concern. For instance, where we've seen mandatory registrations. We've seen some in California. We've seen some in New York, as have been referred to here. And we've had people get letters saying, your gun's now illegal. You need to get it out of the state or we're going to come get it. Well, those of us who don't want to get one of those letters someday, I think reasonably fear that development in the future.
We've also gotten another email question. I want to give you a chance, right, though, on this one, Dr. Dunlop. And we've only got a couple of minutes left.
Wow.
This is from a listener named Scott who says, a major argument for open access to firearms is that criminals will still have access to guns. However, nearly all illegal firearms are acquired through burglary and straw purchasing. In countries where certain weapons are completely banned, they are not available to anybody, with the exception of countries that aren't capable of stopping black market trade. Dr. Dunlop, I'll let you respond to Scott's email.
Yeah, I'll comment on that. I was going to comment on something you said.
Sure. Sure. We're just getting tight, though. So
yeah, it's slipped my slippery mind a little bit. Well, yes, it's true that countries that have decided that certain kind of – oh, I know. It's a question about New York. Well, what happened in New York is that New York passed a law that you couldn't have certain kinds of weapons. You couldn't have weapons with more than a certain magazine. And then people who had those kinds of weapons were told they weren't legal in New York. Now, if they hadn't registered their guns, they wouldn't have gotten the letter, but they'd still been outside of the law. So I think that the question there is that law a reasonable law? And that's being adjudicated as far as I know. And as far as I know, it still is the law. And New York certainly can be proud of their homicide rate.
I think probably. Is there any place that I want to leave this, give both of you about 10 seconds. Is there any place we could find agreement on this issue, some place we could build from? Guy, 10 seconds.
I think absolutely. And I think where there ought to be consensus is on the need for education and training, because we do have far too many instances of irresponsible gun ownership and irresponsible gun use that ends up hurting someone, and we can prevent that.
Real quickly, Dr.
Well, I would hope we can go beyond the education to say, like with seatbelts. You know, it's not just educating people about seatbelts. It's saying you have to use them. So if you have children or minors or felons in your house, you have to store your guns like Guy wants you to.
That will have to be the last word. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm John Kroll. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.